Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Dr. Thomas Carr, who heads up the paleontology program at Carthage College. And of course, if you're a longtime listener to the Morning Show, you've, I'm sure, heard any number of conversations which Dr. Carr and I have had over the years, particularly about the various dinosaur digs in which he has engaged out west and brought back in particular examples of the dinosaur that fascinates him above all others, namely Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Dr. Carr is joining us today because he and a partner in the field have co-authored an important paper that was recently published in the journal Nature, a paper which, in a sense, traces as much as we can possibly know at the moment about the history of T-Rex. That is, where and how did it emerge? Where did it live? How did it develop? How did it evolve? And then at what point did it, in a sense, vanish? It is an intriguing timeline and one which also has, Dr. Carr was telling me, an enormous gap right in the middle of it. In other words, there is a whole lot yet to be discovered about T-Rex and his development over the centuries. And anyway, we have Dr. Carr with us today. He was going to join us a couple of weeks ago, but had to postpone because of ill health. We're glad he's feeling better and can join us today. Dr. Thomas Carr, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you here. So this is a project which has been, in a sense, a long time coming. You were actually trying, before we went on the air, trying to sort of sort out in your mind just how many years we are talking about. And so, in a sense, this is work that you've been doing on top of some of the other work you've been doing. I mean, for instance, working with specific specimens gathered from your dinosaur digs and so on. This is obviously related work, but in a sense, an entirely different project.
Yes. This is something that my collaborator, Stephen Bersatti, who's at the University of Edinburgh, and I started within the reach of the last couple of years. We didn't really get down to it until more recently, and it was a pretty intensive and extensive project to define the evolutionary history of Tyrannosaurus rex and its closest relatives, and as a collectively the lineage is called Tyrannosauroidea, the tyrannosaur tyrant lizard forms. And it's a huge grab bag of animals, large and small, feathery and scaly, that first appeared on the planet, as far as we know, around 170 million years ago, when the planets were still joined together into Pangaea. And they certainly had inauspicious beginnings, and there's even some indication that they may have been globally distributed, both in the northern and southern hemispheres. But the animals that we know best and the best, most reliable data indicate that they were largely from the northern hemisphere and had a fairly extensive history in the north, but they didn't become top predators, the big, large giants, until fairly late in their reign. And there's one earlier exception to that, but the overall trend was that they were small to medium meat-eating dinosaurs, eking out a living in the shadow of larger meat-eaters, more primitive animals, until toward the very end of the Age of Dinosaurs, when there was some great release on their progress was removed by around 85 million years ago, and they became sort of the giant apex predators that we are very familiar with from North America, both in the east and the west of North America, which were separate at the time, and also in Asia. And sort of there is that big gap, and that we can discuss in a bit. But it's a long history. It's an extensive history. And it's complex as well. It's quite a parade of characters.
Right. And it sounds like it is, in a sense, also a contested history, although from the sounds of it, you feel like the work that you and your collaborator have done is about as definitive as such work can possibly be. It might be a little bit tricky to explain, but why don't you do your best to kind of explain how there were, in a sense, dueling stories out there. Another story that was, in a sense, already in circulation, and then the one which you have helped to create, which you think is a better explanation of T-Rex's history.
Right. Well, back in 2010, I described a new primitive advanced tyrannosaur. I'll try to keep the construction simple. A fairly magnificent animal called Bistahiaversor, which means the destroyer from the adobe formations. It's from New Mexico. A large tyrannosaur, but it's not a member of the group, the advanced group that T-Rex belongs to. It's right outside the door of those large giants. It didn't look much different, but when you look at the details, it's pretty clear it's a fairly primitive animal. And we published a phylogeny, my collaborator and I, Thomas Williamson, who works in Albuquerque at the museum there. And we had a particular family tree of Tyrannosaurus that put Bistahiaversor outside the classic Tyrannosaurus, and there's a certain set of relationships that T-Rex had, so its closest relative being something called Tyrannosaurus pitar from Asia and so on. In the same year, I collaborated on a project to recover the family tree of Tyrannosaurus in general. This is where Steve's talents and mine really complement each other. Hmm. I work on the advanced Tyrannosaurus, and Steve has tremendous expertise with the more primitive ones, say from Europe and Asia. And so we combined forces and put our data sets together and to get the big picture of the Tyrannosaur family tree. And at least for the advanced ones, both the Bistahiaversor family tree and the other one, which was published in Science, had the same story, and which made sense because the data sets were largely drawn from the same source, although we had added some to the Science paper. And shortly after that, there was another team that had found some new Tyrannosaur material from Utah, and they presented at one of the professional meetings, Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, their phylogeny, their family tree. And at least for the advanced Tyrannosaurus, the picture was pretty much completely different from the phylogenies, from the family trees that we had published earlier. And since we had ongoing projects and run new versions of our data sets with new data, which were consistent with our earlier results, this really puzzled us. And it took some years before that family tree was published. And when that finally happened in 2014, Steve and I finally had a chance to just dig into the data and really get at these fundamental differences between their results and ours. And so what we decided to do was, well, let's combine these data sets. That's the responsible thing to do as a scientist. When there's new data, you don't ignore it, you include it. And so we sat down with their data set. So imagine a big Excel spreadsheet of zeros and ones. And the zeros and ones code discrete features like, you know, long legs, short versus short legs, tall skull versus short skull, and so on. So these things basically summarize features that are thought to identify families within the big family tree. And we combed through their data set. We got rid of features that had nothing to do with Tyrannosaur evolution. We got rid of characters that were identical to ours. There's a lot of overlap. They drew from our earlier data sets quite heavily. And we also included their new data that we didn't have. And along the way, we do think we identified some areas that were, or sets of features that were making those sort of wonky results. And quite a few of them had to do with skull proportions, you know, skull height versus length, skull depth versus length. And we're able to collapse those down into effectively a hand, you know, one or two characters from what was previously published. So at the end of that process, we coded the final data set, put into the software that reconstructs the tree, clicked the button, and held our breath. And before our unbelieving eyes, we pretty much recovered the structure that we had recovered back in 2010. Huh. And it was pretty clear that the alternate version of history was an artifact of basically double dipping a bunch of features that were really a single feature. At least on the face of it, that's what it looks like.
So it sounds like it was, as much as anything, a misinterpretation of data, or maybe a case where they were paying attention to the wrong things or giving the wrong amount of attention to certain features?
I think just taking one fairly straightforward type of feature and just oversplitting it into many. And that sort of thing, isn't hard to do, especially if you're new to a group and don't quite know all the nuances. So I don't think, I think it was a fairly straightforward, if not innocent, case of sort of the first pass of identifying a bunch of features, then maybe not just sitting back and considering, well, maybe these features are really the same. But, you know, I can't get into their minds, but clearly at the time they regarded those features as independent, and maybe a bit of reflection would have, you know, led to the conclusion that maybe they aren't. But this is the way science works. It is a process. The answers that we come up with are never final or definitive. It's always a process of revision. So it was, at the end of the day, for at least Steve and I, and I guess other workers, it's important to know exactly what was in the mix to begin with. And we need to explain, I guess, the outliers as much as we do need to explain the pattern and truly understand the differences. And so we can learn along the way about how to approach the animals ourselves. So we have another tool in our toolkit of things, sort of, you know, how to approach them and how not to.
We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage College. One of the matters which I should think is of essential importance, and yet I should think really tricky, is the matter of just sorting out what creatures are part of this lineage, since, as you said yourself, when we go to the start of the timeline, the immediate predecessors of what we think of as that iconic dinosaur in the Jurassic Park movies, that these predecessors looked nothing like that. So in what leads you to think that they are part of that lineage at all? I mean, what are the features that in a sense create that through line that makes them predecessors and not just some other sort of creatures who are really not directly related at all?
Right. Well, one of the observations that Darwin made back in 1859 was that, you know, different, you know, life can be divided up into groups of lineages, and those lineages are defined by unique features, and tyrannosaurs are no exception to that pattern. And the primitive tyrannosaurs, the really small gangly ones with, you know, they're small, they have fairly short legs, they have long arms with three-fingered hands. They don't have long feet and two-fingered hands like the later ones. They still possess a suite of fairly arcane anatomical features throughout the skeleton that are shared in common, if not directly, but connect them to the later animals. And so it's pretty clear whether or not these earlier tyrannosaurs are tyrannosaurs or not. Sort of non-tyrannosaurs are truly different. And they possess none of the features that are shared, you know, between T-Rex and the earlier forms. And I think, you know, in part that speaks to sort of the partnership that Steve and I make. The reason why I think it's a very effective one is that we bring a very detailed knowledge of both halves of the family tree when we work together. And, you know, that in the end produces, I think, a pretty sharp picture of the history of the group, since we're both drawing on years of close familiarity with the earlier part and the later part.
Right. You mentioned that there is quite a significant gap in this timeline. I think you said earlier a gap of maybe 30 million years.
No, it's worse than that. It's 45.
45, wow. So, first of all, are we talking about 45 million years in which we essentially have no specimens?
Almost.
Nearly. And and what does T-Rex look like at the start of that gap versus at the end of that gap? I mean, when we get to the end of that gap, is T-Rex a vastly different creature than T-Rex was before the gap?
All right, this is the cool thing. All right, so we've got the earliest tyrannosaurs were around approximately 170 to 125 million years ago, and they're sort of a wonderful, odd group. And to my eye, they don't look like advanced tyrannosaurs at all. They just don't. And I've had to work hard to convince myself that they actually are tyrannosaurs. This is why it's a good thing that Steve and I are working together.
Well, that's what I was asking about before. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they're pretty different. They are pretty odd. And then at around 125, 124 million years ago, this is when that 45 million year gap starts, in the middle of a period of time called the Cretaceous. And it's not until around 83 million years ago that we get all the big advanced tyrannosaurs that we know and love: Albertosaurus, Diplodocus, Tratophonius, Bistachyversor, Zhucheng Tyrannus, and Tyrannosaurus Rex. So they just sort of leap out of the loam, if you'll forgive the expression, out of nowhere, and that's simply because that's where the gap ends. Now, within that gap are two really interesting animals. My favorite, just simply because it's more complete, is a wonderful animal from China called Xiangguanlong.
Great name.
It's really fantastic. And to my eye, Xiangguanlong is a real tyrannosaur. It's got the lovely boxy head, the long snout, the big teeth, and just overall, at a glance, it's a tyrannosaur. Even though the original skull's badly crushed, it's clearly an advanced tyrannosaur. But it's not all the way there yet. The issue with Xiangguanlong is that we really don't know how old it is, so the rocks that it came from are poorly aged. And it could be anywhere from 125 to 100 million years old. I mean, that's, you know, a 20 million year error, and that's just that's just awful. We really don't know where it fits in terms of time, but we do know that it postdates the earlier ones. And just earlier this year, I think it was, it was earlier this year, there was a really cool animal from Uzbekistan found, and called Timurlengia. And Timurlengia is basically a handful of scraps, but it's clear that Timerlangia lived around 92 million years ago, and that its closest relative among other tyrannosaurs was probably Xiangguanlong. So we have these two intermediate tyrannosaurs that look like tyrannosaurs, and I accept them into the fold, and they're transitional in form. They really are. They're halfway in form between the earlier ones and the classic late ones. And so this is a critical interval between roughly 125 to 83 million years. There's a tremendous amount of missing history there. And right now we only have two data points, which are both from Asia, which bespeak an extraordinarily extensive and diverse history that is yet to be discovered.
Now, do you have any idea why this gap exists or has existed? I mean, is there a sensible explanation for why we should be missing sample material from such a span of time? I mean, was something going on here in the world on planet Earth at this time that would give us some kind of explanation?
I think it's the reason is there's a couple aspects to it. I think the first is that these mid-Cretaceous deposits, well, I'll just back up and say that fossil deposits, you know, aren't common. They aren't everywhere. They aren't equally distributed across the globe. We don't have every time slice represented equally. And we haven't explored everywhere. So it's a combination of these factors that make the mid-Cretaceous interval really poorly known. And the areas that are being explored, say in Uzbekistan and certain areas in China, are pretty remote. And in the meantime, there's only so many people, and we all have different and specific research projects and goals and areas that we go back to. So it's, I think it's a combination of those factors. But, you know, it's not the only time slice that we know very little about. For instance, within the classic tyrannosaurs, there's this frustrating gap between roughly 69 and 67.5 million years ago. This is the interval in which T-Rex made its appearance in Western North America, and the Western classic North American tyrannosaurs went extinct. And we're missing that time slice that would explain how that transition happened. So was it, you know, sort of a competitive replacement sort of thing? Was T-Rex an invasive species that came in and, pardon me, wiped out the resident tyrannosaurs? Did the resident tyrannosaurs go extinct before T-Rex came in from Asia? Which, by the way, is one of the unanticipated results of our work. Was it looks like T-Rex was an invasive species from Asia. And the reason why we didn't see that before is that our new study included as many new discoveries of tyrannosaur species as possible. And so our data set for advanced Asian tyrannosaurs increased. And if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have recovered this signal of T-Rex possibly being an invasive species.
Wow. I was going to say you wonder, but you probably know very directly how often those kind of inadvertent discoveries get made in the world of science, particularly in the field of science in which you are engaged.
Yeah, it's every bit of data matters, and part and parcel of that, especially with working with a group like tyrannosaurs, you really have to know the variation, sort of the rules of what these animals look like, what features count and what don't. Tyrannosaurs are not easy. They're messy. And it takes a great deal of work looking at a lot of fossils to work out, you know, the features that really might mean something in terms of evolution, the big picture, and those that might not, but be just as informative in terms of growth or just the overall noise of what things look like. And just to get back to that gap, the only areas where we have rocks around 69 million years old are in Alberta and Alaska. Mm. And so for North America, our only data points are represented by two species. And they do have a clear place on the family tree. But in terms of the geological record, it's silent. Because in North America, it's largely marine deposits at that time. We just don't have the terrestrial deposit.
Ah, so we were too much of us were underwater at that point.
Yeah, at least in the areas where we had the sedimentation that was flowing down from the mountains, the early Rocky Mountains, you know, burying the fossils. It just simply isn't there.
Interesting. So in what way does this paper set up you and your colleagues for further research? I mean, does it, for instance, pose very specific questions or point people into other paleontologists into certain directions in terms of pursuing a more complete picture of T-Rex's history?
Yeah, what we've done is we've provided a combined data set. So there's hundreds of features now that people can add to. We've provided, I think, a fairly stable framework that people can add their data to. So there's no reason really for anyone to go out and reinvent the wheel in terms of working on Tyrannosaur history, Tyrannosaur evolution. There's a data set that's available for people to add to and publish on. We've identified the major gaps in the history of the group, and we've also blocked out sort of the overall transition from the primitive ones to the classic late Tyrannosaurs. And we've also, you know, along with that, each relationship, say the closest relative of T-Rex or these Asian things, each of those are testable hypotheses. And so it could be that tomorrow someone adds, you know, finds some new Tyrannosaur, and it could completely change the relationships in terms of their evolutionary relationships and where animals may have originated and, you know, moved from one place to another. The picture will certainly change. And, you know, and I expect that for the classic Tyrannosaurs. We really only know the last 20 million years of their history. And that history didn't start, at least to my mind, it didn't get really started until 20 million years previous, around 100 million years ago. And so there's this significant gap that we have yet to see from 100 to, say, 80 million years ago that would explain the relationships that we see among the classic Tyrannosaurs. We just simply don't know. It's undiscovered country, and it may stay that way for some time. You know, in terms of rocks of that age at the surface, at least in North America, they're few and far between.
But you are guardedly optimistic that some of these vexing questions are going to be answered?
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be incremental, as these things usually are. I think one of the areas with greatest potential continues to be China. The fossil record there is quite extensive in terms of time and space. Many of the new discoveries of Tyrannosaurs are from Asia and, you know, adjacent regions. I think Shangguanlong and Timor-Langia are excellent examples of those. There's advanced animals like Aeloramus and Kianzosaurus that are really weird. They have these long Pinocchio-like snouts with many, many teeth, but they look primitive, but they're really quite advanced animals. And a lot of these fossils are coming out of China and Mongolia. And so I think that if there's going to be a renaissance, that's where the bulk of the new fossils are going to come from. And I suspect that for North America, we're going to see a lot of new material coming out of older rocks, say around 80 million years in that neighborhood, and a bit older from areas like southern Alberta and Utah, which, you know, I know that there's scientific teams there that are focusing on the older rocks and to recover early versions of classic later tyrannosaurs, dinosaurs, not just tyrannosaurs,
right,
but horned dinosaurs, duckbills, ostrich dinosaurs, you name it, they all need explaining. All the late classic dinosaurs are suffering from the same deficit of data. And we will see those gaps get filled, in those regions. So I'm optimistic, but it will be incremental and piecemeal, as it has been for quite some time.
It takes patience to do what you do. Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage College, this is a fascinating conversation. I'm so glad to know about this work that you've been doing, and we look forward to all of your further visits to The Morning Show. Thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to talk with you. Here's part two of today's Morning Show on WGTD. I have been thoroughly enjoying a brand new book called The Last Girl, book one in what is called the Dominion Trilogy, and it's by bestselling author Joe Hart. It is really an amazing book, tremendously exciting. It paints a picture of a world which has been, in a sense, rent asunder by a disastrous turn of events that is, to a large extent, mysterious and unexplained. That is, there is a precipitous drop in the rate of female births. Almost all births are male rather than female, which leads to a huge upsurge of chaos in society, and a kind of a breakdown of all normal rules, and widespread destruction, and ultimately a rebuilding of sorts. And it is in this strange new world that we follow the exploits of a girl named Zoe. She is being kept in a strange facility, and she and other girls like her supposedly kept safe there because they are key to the continuation of the human race in this terrible new scenario. But not all seems to be as it seems or as they are told. And Zoe is tireless in her efforts to find out exactly what has happened to the world, how she has found herself in this place, and she ultimately is determined to escape. That at least is part of the incredibly exciting story of The Last Girl. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with the author of this really terrific book, Joe Hart. He has been writing for many, many years, the author of 8 novels, and he has done some terrific work in this book, which sets off his Dominion Trilogy. And the book is published by Thomas and Mercer. Joe Hart, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I really, really enjoyed this. And I want to say I very seldom deal with fiction on this program. It's far more often that I'm reading nonfiction, and even for fun, reading nonfiction. So when a work of fiction grabs my imagination, you've really accomplished something, and you have done that with this really, really terrific book. I wonder if you could just say a word about what it feels like to create a world like this, a world which has been sort of tilted upside down, and a world that it is in so many ways a bleak, violent place. I mean, what does that give you as a writer to create a world like that? I mean, what is that experience like?
Sure. The experience, it's kind of two-sided there. It's you know, at one point, you know, when you have to visualize, you know, how everything, the fallout and the circumstances, it's terrifying. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, you pull from real life experiences and things that are happening in the world, and kind of extrapolate on those types of things, which, in all honesty, it's a possibility of happening, a lot of these things, you know, that could spin the world off its axis, so to speak. So it's terrifying in that aspect because you see how delicate the human race is. you know, as a writer and as, you know, kind of world building, it's very liberating because you kind of have destruction at your fingertips. You can create and destroy different things, really, really make it up as you go along and envision kind of a fun, kind of like a romp through this post-apocalyptic world, and you can have a lot of fun creating these twists and turns for your characters. So it's kind of twofold. It's got two sides of the coin there as far as creation goes.
I think that these kind of works can ring true, feel incredibly authentic, and in other cases they can really feel very fanciful and I would say false. I really tend to be much more a fan of the former, where one feels like something truly plausible has been created. And I think that's what you've done here. How hard did you think about that whole matter of sort of plausibility and authenticity as you created The Last Girl?
You know, it definitely was at the forefront. You know, when you go to write any fiction, you know, like you said, unless it's an absolute, you know, fanciful work where, bizarro fiction, something like that, where it doesn't have to make sense, you always try to keep that sense of place and time and reality to the work. So it was definitely on the forefront, like I said there. I went through all the different scenarios, what I thought would happen, what the fallout would be if, you know, females were no longer being born. And, of course, that opened up a lot of very good jumping-off points for social commentary and, you know, misogyny in our society and things like that. So I definitely wanted to ground the story in a lot of things that are happening today. So that definitely kept me on track as far as being, you know, writing and pushing the plot forward. It definitely helped. So, yes.
Tell us about that sort of central core of the story, this strange phenomenon, perhaps a plague or something else, which has caused the birth rate of female babies to plunge to almost nothing, which, of course, threatens the very existence of the human race. Do you remember the moment when that notion came to you as what I assume was kind of the starting point of this whole story?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it was just kind of, I was just kind of musing, which, you know, is how a lot of my ideas come along. I kind of sit and daydream a little bit, and I just was thinking about, you know, the fragility of human species and how, you know, the Zika virus, and, you know, we had the Ebola scare here in this country, and whereas, you know, it was a very serious threat in other countries. And I just thought about, you know, how easily, you know, we as a species could be, you know, threatened, especially on a genetic level. So, and then the idea just kind of came to me. I thought, well, what if female, you know, infants were no longer born? And I thought, well, how, you know, how quickly we would disappear off the face of the earth within a generation or so, you know, within a very short time we would be gone. And that, like I said, that kind of led me to that social question. I thought, well, you know, how would women, the remaining women that were born, how would they be treated? And I felt like I should pose this to a woman. So I asked my wife. I said, you know, I said, what's in your opinion? I said, if there was very few women left on the earth, I said, do you think they would be treated like queens or like prisoners? And she didn't even bat an eye. She said, prisoners. And, you know, it was the same response that I asked every other woman, you know, in my life. Friends and family, they all came back with that same answer that, you know, the women would be treated like prisoners. And I felt like that was definitely, you know, the way I was leaning to tell the story, too. So it was, you know, the premise right off the bat was exciting, and then of course my main character right away started speaking to me, and I knew that it was going to be told from her perspective. Mm. So, yeah.
I think one of the things that really makes this feel realistic is that Zoe and the other young women who are housed with her in this strange facility are all very different from each other. I mean, they are very much individuals, including one who is emotionally or mentally a bit damaged. Mm-hmm. We might think of her as maybe someone with special needs. And somehow that made all of this even more realistic. And I think similar kinds of works often paint with kind of a broad brush, and everybody comes off as kind of a generic construct. And it seems to me you really labored to make each of these young women their own unique individual, and you're not afraid to make some of them rather unpleasant people as well. They're not all heroines.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it was, you know, it's always fun developing characters, and all the characters in this book, like I said, they were almost immediately birthed, fully formed, you know, so to speak, when I started writing. When I knew that, you know, there was going to be certain antagonists, and, you know, against Zoe and whatnot, they came, you know, together very well. And what's neat is, since this is a trilogy, is, you know, many characters that are introduced in the first book, we get a glimpse at them, we get a first impression of them, but they continue on throughout the trilogy and grow and change. And you get to see a little bit more of why they were the way they were in the first book, especially, which is, you know, commonplace in trilogies, you know, to kind of give the reader a kind of a viewpoint on characters and expand there. So it was a lot of fun knowing the arc that each character was going to take in the series of the three books. So it was very fun.
And I know we don't want to give too much away, but I think there's no escaping us at least touching on the fact that Zoe does manage to escape this facility only with great, great difficulty, and finds herself in the outer world and encountering various people, various groups of people, and they also are quite distinct from one another. I mean, there is not really a sameness to the survivors. There are some who are very much are predators and others who are good-hearted, compassionate people. And I also feel like that variety, that variation is part of what makes this world you have created feel very authentic.
Going back to the characters again, it's I really tried to envision, you know, what types of people would survive and what kind of threats she would encounter, you know, when she does escape from the research facility that she's been housed at. And you know, it's society set up in a way that most people are law-abiding citizens, and they would help you if you were in need. But I really looked at the constructs of, you know, what would happen if those needs were gone, you know, if society was no longer there, if policing of laws were no longer there, how many people would begin to take things for their own and whatnot. You'd still, like you said, you'd still run into the good-hearted person or the person that would definitely help you or house you or, you know, feed you if you were starving. But you definitely would run into the other sort who would take whatever they could from you.
So right.
I
also think that we come to appreciate the value of intelligence and ingenuity in such a world where one has to sort of create something out of next to nothing and improvise every step along the way and lay the most carefully wrought plans in order to survive in such a world. And I appreciate that some of these survivors are not just surviving through sheer force of will and brute strength, but also with intelligence and ingenuity and imagination.
Yeah. No, that was definitely important, especially, you know, for the main character being, you know, held captive. You know, really, when I tell people about the book, you know, I say, you know, the first part of the book is, in essence, a prison break story. You know, it's definitely in emotional and physical, both for the main character. She's breaking out of the prison that she's been put in and told, you know, about her whole life. I had a lot of fun basically kind of writing myself into a corner there, especially with her physical escape, and having her be very crafty and intelligent about how she would get out of a situation.
Right.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Of course, a lot of post-apocalyptic stories have been created. And as I read The Last Girl, I certainly am not saying that this is a derivative work. I really liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. But of course, we at least catch a whiff of other such stories that have been written before. I mean, it's impossible to read a book like The Last Girl and not at least catch a little hint of other works that have come before it. For you as the author, how consciously did you have to think about other works that had come before? I mean, whether they're the more kind of fanciful things like Mad Max or something much more realistic like Children of Tomorrow, how consciously did you feel like you needed to steer this story into sort of new ground so it wouldn't fall into the trap of being too derivative?
Sure, yeah. You know, and I'm a pretty big fan of post-apocalyptic work. not so much science fiction, the hard science fiction side of things. So I was kind of safe, so to speak, on certain areas with the science fiction background. Excuse me. And the premise I felt was pretty original. You know, there'd been situations where women, you know, were scarce in the world before, but the idea of them not being born was fairly unique. So I felt like I had a great premise there. But you know, definitely influences. I've read a lot of Stephen King, so I mean, Stand is definitely an influence. Justin Cronin's The Passage trilogy. All great works, and I really wanted to just, you know, have a lot of fun with that post-apocalyptic landscape, but I trusted myself, the intuition, and where the characters would take me. So I feel like when you're basing the story off of the characters and their decisions, they come to life and they guide the story. Mm. So I wasn't too concerned about getting into real familiar territory, with the characters in the driver's seat, so to speak. So I had a lot of fun with that because I had some good plot twists and different things in my mind that I felt were pretty original. But then I really leaned on my characters to guide the story themselves. So that was. I wasn't too concerned about, like you said, following the same path.
Right, and I think you succeeded admirably. A last quick question: this is book one of a trilogy. What kind of challenge is that to create a story with that sort of substantial arc?
Yeah.
I mean, is that entire trilogy already sort of set in your mind? How firm is that framework?
Yeah, when I first got the idea, the story kind of mostly came, fully formed, and I kind of knew where I wanted it to go. So I sat down and started outlining it, and it just kept growing and growing. And I spoke with my editor, and she said, "Well, it sounds like a great, story. It sounds like it's going to be a great book." And I said, "I think it's going to be three books." And so I went back and I really started plotting out the course of the novel again. And I could just see the breaks where, it was going to be three books. And so definitely had to do some outlining. I'm kind of a hybrid between a pantser and an outliner, so I like to get a framework going and then leave myself enough room to grow and my characters to move around in the plot. So it was... It's daunting in some ways because, you have to definitely make sure all the loose ends are tied up by the end of the third book, which I'm writing now. But it's also very liberating because you have so much more room to tell this story over the course of three books and, almost 300,000, 350,000 words. So it's